is the Wake Up Zone, powered by All Four Seasons Garage Doors, with Blaine Bishop, Mark Howard, and Kevin Ingram on 104.5 The Zone.
.903 on the Wake Up Zone at 104.5 The Zone. Mark Howard along with Blaine Bishop. Kevin Ingram off this week. Our producer, Jonathan Schaefer, of course, with a major presence from the Zone studios. A little bit of breaking news. The NFL Players Association and the owners have agreed on a facility protocol, a club facility protocol during training camp. A couple, not only with the testing, but also demanding that the players stay 6 feet away from each other when they're not on the practice field. So that's going to be really interesting and odd to watch as camp goes along. There is also fan presence. Teams are allowed to have two fan events at the stadium, during practice, as long as the fans don't come on the field, but they too have to keep a social distance. Blaine, how odd is that going to be to watch? Not only the players, but the fans keeping a safe social distance.
Well, to be honest, Mark, I think it's going to be a little easier for the fans if they've been cooperating, going out in public, like going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be different. You're going to be outside, and naturally, you're going to stand next to the person you significant other or family or friend. So I think it's going to be a happy medium. I don't want people going around saying, "Hey, stay away from each other," or they have to wear a mask. I'm assuming they will. We're in Nashville, as you know, where the facility's at. But I think it's going to be hard for the players to stay 6 feet away as well. Are they going to have inside the facility, saying these markers are where you're supposed to be standing in the hallway while you're walking? Or are you walking out of the cafeteria just generally talking to somebody? Maybe you're talking about the plays or, a play that happened at practice. I think it's going to be really hard for the players to do it. I think the fans is going to be a little bit easier because you may have somebody out there monitoring them, saying, "Hey, make sure you stay 6 feet apart." Well, at some point, the players are the players, and they're together, and everybody's not watching their every move. So I think this one here, inside the facility that's not, built for, 90 guys, unless they split them up and have meetings at different times, which I'm interested to see how they do that, because that's probably – it makes sense to me. Now I want to see how the smart people now facilitate that happening. Will you have some players, let's say offensive players, at the stadium, by the way, meeting in the locker room, stand 6 feet away, and then you have maybe the defense stand at the facility and vice versa, or maybe in the bubble for meetings, a certain portion of players, all right? And then, you young players, guess where you get to meet? Outside under a tent. I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing it out there. And naturally, it's just like, being a freshman on the team or you carry the pads, they kind of get the wrong end of the stick here, joking about the whole situation. So how do they manage through that? But it's always going to be tough, whether you're fans, players, to really keep with mandated things that are not natural to you to stay, 6 feet from one another. That's going to be tough for the fans as well as the player. I would hope that it's a little bit easier, but as we've seen, people still are going out downtown or wherever, and it's hard to stay 6 feet apart. So with that being said, they're probably going to have people out there telling them, "Hey, we got to do this and got to do that," watching those guys all over the place, our fans all over the place. So, yeah, still just a tough situation. I think you lose either way if you're trying to mandate the fans as well as the players. I just don't know how you're going to be able to do that.
A little bit later this hour, at about 9:15, we're going to have Dennis Dodd on from CBSSports.com to give you his perspective on college football and where they are now with all the COVID testing and the workouts. And then at the end of the hour, Pete Sweeney, who covers the Kansas City Chiefs for SB Nation, wrote a really interesting column on just what happened in the whole Pat Mahomes negotiation for that 10-year, $400 million contract. But, talking about camp and talking about maybe a smile on his face, Tom Brady, unusually giddy about getting a chance to get out there and play. In fact, he texted his throwing coach, Tom House, that football is fun again. And yesterday, I asked Zach Cox, who covers the Patriots, for Nesson, how he interpreted that tweet.
It's been a big kind of storyline around here the final few years of Brady's tenure, that he just didn't feel like he was having as much fun as he did earlier in his career for whatever reason, for kind of tension with Bill Belichick, for last year it was a lot of unhappiness with the players that were around him, with the kind of talent that he had at wide receiver and at tight end. And I think that he feels like he's kind of in a fresh start and in a new scenario, and you can't have much better or many better players around him, many better skill players than he has down there in Tampa with Gronk, with Mike Evans, with Chris Godwin, O.J. Howard, all of those guys down there. He has to view that as a basically kind of an answer to his prayers for what he was asking for last year. Now, we'll see how it all goes once kind of the teams reconvene and he's actually playing under a new coaching staff and in a slightly new system and all that, how that works out. But right now, I think he feels a little rejuvenated in being outside of New England and kind of getting to try something new for himself.
That was Zach Cox from Nesson, and it was actually a text to Tom House and not a tweet. But, Blaine, you were saying this all along, that things were not hunky-dory between Belichick and Brady. That text was pretty revealing. It's hard not to interpret things that way, that he was happy to be away from the man in the hoodie.
I tried to tell you. But, you know, to all fairness to the great one, Bill Belichick, he treated him no different than everybody else. And we all know that's not how that process is supposed to work, especially as much as Tom Brady has his skins on the wall and what he has done, not only for the organization, what he's done to help them facilitate those six championships. So I think, you know, when the caves start, you know, when wall starts coming in on the quarterback, and then he has really no say-so, and he see things happening that he feels like is helping him not be great or up to standard, you know, he really had no voice. So if things got a little rough, and naturally he had to take the heat, and he said this is enough, and that's probably why, as I said then, is why he wasn't going to those off-season deals. He needed a break from the great one and the meticulous military attitude that Bill Belichick brings every time you're there. And that's the reason why. It shows out. And there's nothing wrong, because that leads to success. But at some point, can I breathe? I'm TB. TB12. I got you. We've been here before. Let's relax. And then maybe Tom didn't get as much influence on the offense as he thought he should, because he was out there and he wasn't happy, not only with the players. So then he tried to adapt and be more so with the offense, changed some things, and they didn't say, no, Tom, you do it our way or no way. And so he said, you know what, it's probably time to move on. And I firmly thought he was going to leave, and he did. He had the opportunity to.
Yeah, there wasn't really anything really ambiguous there about that text. So, it was a shot at his old coach. And that's all you need to say about that. All right, straight ahead, we're going to speak to Dennis Dodd. A lot going on in college football. 9:12 on the Wake Up Zone on 104.5 The Zone. .918 on the Wake Up Zone, powered by All Four Seasons Garage Doors. Mark Howard, along with Blaine Bishop, Kevin Off this week, and our producer Jonathan Schaefer, getting it done from the Zone Studio. Let's bring in our old friend and college football writer for CBSSports.com, Dennis Dodd. Dennis, good morning.
How are you guys? Nice to hear you again.
We're hanging in there, Dennis. You've written so much in the last, you know, couple of months about the evolving story of college football, but your latest column essentially said TikTok. College football, maybe a few months ago, was talking about different scenarios, but suddenly, we're closing in on August 29th, which would be week zero of the college football season. But talk about what you discussed in terms of time running out now on college football.
Well, just through this whole thing, since this started March 12th in the NCAA tournament, got shut down in the NCAA, stopped the spring athletics at that point. That the stakeholders always said, well, we've got time. We've got time to figure out the calendar. We've got time to figure out testing. We've got time to, figure out a schedule, how we're going to play. Not so much anymore. We're going to know, guys, by the end of this month, likely which way this is headed. Because actual practice for those week one games on Labor Day weekend begins August 7th. And I don't think it would be prudent to send players out there in the middle of a pandemic to start swapping sweat and practicing and being in close quarters if you're thinking about playing. You've got to make a decision. You either go or no go. And frankly, right now, I don't have to tell anybody. It doesn't look good right now.
What about the possibility of moving it to the spring?
Well, that's always been out there. It was the last resort because there is no other resort. I mean, this is not a sport that lends itself to being moved around on the calendar, obviously. So, yeah, I mean, that's the last resort with the assumption that things are going to be better. Look, the trail they're going right now is, fingers crossed, we hope, this thing doesn't break out or we have to shut it down 5 weeks in. Because you can't control it. The virus doesn't care. Would things be better next spring? It might, but we don't know. It's in the middle of flu season, part of that year is going to be. You're going to be bringing players back and working more inside than they would now because of the climate, because of the winter. And there's all, then you get to the possibility of playing two seasons in 1 year. And at what point, it's little about this right now. Looks like it's tempered the education, the ramp up. Now, the Ivy League is going to go to the spring today. Yeah, they've been leaders in this. They were the first to cancel their conference tournaments. They're going to go to the spring in football and hope to ride it out then with conference games only. But the big boys, the Power Five, FCS, it has little to do with education right now. It's all about getting a portion of that TV money.
Dennis, one of the things that you wrote about was the inequities that exist in terms of testing and protocols and everything else when you go state to state. And that's obviously going to carry over when you start making considerations on if we're going to see football, talking about what's going on in California, what's going on in Texas. So what happens if the rest of the country is ready and those schools in those states aren't?
Well, I've said this from the beginning. I think, if there's football, the commissioners have made it clear in the fall that not all 10 conferences may go. And within those 10 conferences, not all the teams within those conferences may go. I mean, I clearly think that we could have teams play 6 games, others play 8, others play 10. And it just becomes a mishmash. How do you figure out how to decide a champion? And you've got, guys, 41 states that have major college football teams in them. Within those states, you have different health boards, different city health boards, county commissions, state health boards. They've also got to be aligned too. I mean, who wants to go to Florida right now? So that's what I said. It doesn't look good. And if you're not, I haven't heard anything talk about students on campus lately. USC is going to go online this fall. Does that mean they're out? Remember, at one time, it was no students on campus, no football. Seems like there's some waffling on that.
We're speaking to Dennis Dodd from CBSSports.com.
Well, Dennis, you mentioned a lot of different things, with the protocols, different each state, just because of the state of, where they're at with the virus. I guess I want to go in a little different direction and the empowerment of the college athlete. Where is the fine line with some of these college athletes? And they're kind of putting the coaches in a position where they almost are forced to at times to cave into to some of their demands, which they may disagree with. How do they politely disagree with them as well?
Yeah, the athlete has been empowered. I think we've seen that during this downtime, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's name, image, and likeness. But it was coming anyway. I just think they've gotten smarter. I think they've been enlightened to what's going on. But a lot of this enterprise is built on their sweat and labor, and they're not compensated for it. And don't tell me about free scholarships, because for the most part, those scholarships are renewable year to year. And if the coach doesn't like your performance, you can find a way to take that scholar away. So, and a scholarship isn't going to protect you from having two knee replacements 20 years from now. So they realize that. I mean, you saw what happened with the very insensitive conduct of Mike Gundy at Oklahoma State. Illinois players spoke out. If UCLA players spoke out, they weren't sure about their health care going into voluntary workouts. So I think that's going to be part of the future. It's just a reality. These coaches are going to have to deal with this. It dawned on me, Blaine, this week that, you know, we'd be really farther along in this whole enterprise right now if we had a players' union. I'm not saying that they should be paid or anything like that. If you could negotiate with the players' union on work conditions, testing, everything else, doesn't make them professional, but it sure as heck would make them safer if you could negotiate with them. But we're going to get that way when we have name, image, and likeness. Coaches are going to have to start meeting with marketing agents. And those marketing agents, at some point or another, can start talking about playing time. But that's the new reality. I don't think it's necessarily a negative.
What do you think is going to happen now with all this process on the recruiting kind of changing a little bit, let alone guys not to play in the spring on transfers, and even not just the transfer portals, a lot of guys just sitting there, but will we see more, is this the beginning and the end of transferring, from the start till where we are today?
Well, the way it sits, and everything's in a mishmash now because of the virus, we are supposed to get legislation on one-time transfers coming out of the NCAA convention in January. It's not going to be a waiver. It's going to be a legislation. Well, you can do it, which is absolutely fair. There's whatever it is. There's five sports, football among them, where you have to sit out for no, good reason. It's very hypocritical. For every other sport, you can transfer once in your career without sitting out. Why shouldn't every sport be like that? So that's going to happen. I mean, that's more of what the player empowerment you're talking about. I remember Nick Saban saying a few years ago, am I going to have to change the way I coach? And I immediately thought, you know what? Maybe you do. And maybe that's not a bad thing for him or any other coach, because they're going to have to consider this, with their conduct with these players. And look at the basketball landscape. 40% of basketball players transfer in Division I on average before the end of their sophomore year. I don't know how you end that. But I sure as heck like the freedom, because they have the same freedom as any other student on campus.
What do you think about maybe pushing back and delaying the start of the college football season, particularly the Power Five? And do you think that's possible and more realistic than ever before now?
Oh, yeah, that's all on the table. I mean, everything is on the table. A late start, an October start, a November start, two semester football, conference games only, conference games plus one non-conference game, spring football. It's all on the table. Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, was quoted as saying there are 18 to 20 possibilities out there. I have a hard time thinking of 18 to 20, but the commissioners sure have thought of it, and all that's on the table. You could definitely do that just to get in some sort of semblance of a season, because the opposite of that is no football, and if that happens, we're going to see schools give up college athletics, and maybe on the lower end, schools cease to become schools. They just can't afford to do it anymore.
We're on with Dennis Dodd, national college football writer for CBSSports.com.
Dennis, around here, we have a lot of group of five schools. We have, the OVC. We have all of that. Talk about the differing mindsets, at the Power Five level and the Group of Five level that doesn't have the kind of TV money the media rights money that the Power Five has?
Well, the biggest part of that is below the FBS level. Largely, those schools in FBS Division II and Division III can't afford to test. They're just shooting these guys with those temperature gauges on their forehead as they come in the door. I talked to an FBS program yesterday, a head coach, who said players are paying for their tests on their own as they report. In other words, they got a note from their doctor. That's incredible to me. And his president has told him, you know, if we have to test during the season, which I think everyone has to do, we'll find the money for it. They estimated it at $200,000. But the point is, these lower division schools can't afford it. I mean, there's some schools, some of the MAC schools in FCS can't afford testing. So that's the biggest thing. That's what I'm talking about. They have to avoid at all costs sending these players out there with any hint that they're human shields or mercenaries being thrown out there to get get money for these programs. And that's what's happening at some level already.
Well, yeah, you're right. And the other aspect of this is, we're placing a lot of emphasis on workouts and even when they get to preseason practices. But then if you start exposing these players to the college community, what are we going to be in store for during the regular season when, our whole offensive line and the starting quarterback test positive?
Concern. I wrote about that last week where, you had, I think there's at least six schools, Power Five or maybe FCS, that have shut down for a period of time after positive outbreak. Well, what's going to happen when 40,000 students come on campus? And again, like I mentioned, they actually start playing football and practicing football. I don't think the positives are going to go down. Maybe I'm missing something, but, the answer to this has been the answer since the beginning. Until we have a vaccine or some sort of therapeutic to treat it, we're just going to be dancing between the raindrops and hope the big thunderstorm doesn't hit, because that's what we're doing right now.
And then there's the whole morality, and you talked about this a little bit, of having college athletes who aren't being paid. Yeah, they're getting scholarships, but this is a lot different than the pro sports. Whereas you mentioned, there's no union for the collegiate athletes. Everybody else has a union that's negotiating with them as far as the protocols and everything else. And there just seems to be this mentality that the players are being sort of used as guinea pigs.
Yeah, and I get that they want to play. I'm not saying they don't want to play, but sometimes they don't know what they don't know. I talked to an infectious disease doctor from UAB. Michael Sag, I would urge people to look him up. He's fantastic, very knowledgeable. He actually had COVID, and he said, he told me, it runs through all your organs when it goes through you. Now, some don't even feel it, but some have their wrecked for life. We don't know. I mean, 3 months later, he's over it. He can't climb a set of stairs without being short of breath. He doesn't know if his lungs are damaged permanently. And look, I know in the younger population, it doesn't seem to hit them as much. But it's the whole mask argument. I hate to get into that. But you can give it to somebody else. You can give it to your 65-year-old coach. I counted in FBS, there are 17 coaches, head coaches, never mind assistants, who are 60 years old or older. That's not good. So it's a bad look right now. And to think it's just going to magically disappear, I think, is naive. Because I agree with everything you said. I think it's a tough time.
Other sort of, maybe unintended consequence too, Dennis, schools are going to take a bit of a financial bath. What about how it affects the way coaches are paid?
Yeah, I'm working on that story right now. I think, in a sense, it gives coaches more job security because the sitting coaches right now, the schools aren't going to have enough money to buy a house, not to mention what it would cost to hire a new coach. I think, one of the reasons Kirk Ferentz is still employed at Iowa after that big dust-up with his strength coach, I think his buyout is $22.5 million. Well, Iowa probably can't afford that. So they can find a way to justify keeping this guy, even though the accusations against him and others on the staff keep coming, even after they've gotten rid of the strength coach. I think in the long run, the market will adjust, and we'll see, not the end, but an adjustment on the buyouts, which are, I think everybody understands, are largely too much. The top 10 highest paid coaches, I looked at the USA Today database for the highest paid coaches, top 10 paid coaches, their average buyout, not their salary, their buyout, $28.9 million they were fired today. That's amazing.
A lot of us, on one hand, sort of intellectually understand that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's at the high school, college, or pro level, that the athletes and the coaches too are sort of being put in harm's way. But then there's the other side of us that just want to see the games. We're sort of getting tired about hearing how the sausage is made and all of that, Dennis. Are you conflicted in any way about that too?
I don't see how you put people in stadiums at this point. I mean, I know schools are selling tickets and season tickets, and Ohio State's talking about putting 50,000 in this year. I just don't see the science in it. I mean, yeah, here's some beer. We'll tell you to wear a face mask, and you're going to sit 6 feet apart and cough and yell and scream all over each other. That doesn't make sense at all. I mean, the only way to stop this, again, science, the only way to stop these viruses, going back to the Black Plague in the Middle Ages, you separate, you don't gather. You know, you wear a mask. Have you seen these pictures from the pandemic in 1918 with the flu? People are at football games, every single one of them, even though they're sitting together, they've gotten smart enough to wear masks. They're all wearing masks. If you just see that, the science proves to knock this down fairly quickly. I think right now, just having people in the stands, look what baseball's doing, NFL. I always talk about fans in the stands, NHL. Right now, I don't know. I don't get the science behind college football modeling that right now.
Dennis, great stuff as always. Good to speak to you. Stay safe and keep up the good work.
Yeah, I hope we have some football soon, guys. Thanks.
All right, that's Dennis Dodd from CBS Sports. All right, straight ahead, we're going to talk to Pete Sweeney, who covers the Kansas City Chiefs, a radio personality in Kansas City. So we'll get to that subject. 9:36 on the Wake Up Zone on 104.5 The Zone. On the Wake Up Zone on 104.5 The Zone, powered by All Four Seasons Garage Doors. Mark Howard, Blaine Bishop, Kevin off this week. Our producer, Jonathan Schaefer. Top of the hour, of course, midday 180. But first, let's bring in Pete Sweeney, who covers the Kansas City Chiefs for SB Nation. He's also a radio personality. Pete, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Great. Very interesting story that you wrote about the negotiations between the Patrick Mahomes camp and the Chiefs. Talk about the philosophy that Mahomes had going into this negotiation and how it played out in his contract.
Yeah, covering Mahomes now since the beginning of his Chiefs career, you've always got this sense that this is a guy who is wise beyond his years, that he truly understands the business of the game, and that's constantly credited to his father being a longtime Major League Baseball pitcher and Patrick Mahomes Sr. and his godfather, LaTroy Hawkins, who also played in the MLB. And he's got some good agents who surround him and let him know, you want to go in this certain direction. And so even at the age of 24, he's thinking about what his legacy is going to look like. And from the beginning, as it seemed like from what he was describing yesterday, he was in seeking two principles for a contract. He wanted financial security for generations to come. He thought he had played well enough to achieve that. And he also wanted the Chiefs to have enough flexibility so that they could work with the contract. It would be flexible. They can make some changes, and they could have enough salary cap to continue to surround him with talent and reward players. It's crazy to say that a contract that could be worth up to $500 million, which is $500 million, is also team-friendly, but that is what we are dealing with in this new 10-year contract extension for Patrick Mahomes.
You mentioned a concern about his legacy, interesting in your story how you talked about how influenced Patrick was by watching Last Dance, and how Michael Jordan looked upon his run with the Bulls.
Yeah, no doubt. This was something that, you know, it kind of captivated everyone this summer, because once sports paused, everyone was so starved for some kind of appointment television when it came to sports. And Patrick Mahomes frequently would tweet, almost live tweet, Michael Jordan. And so this is something that I thought of yesterday. It was worth asking him, you know, how did that have an impact on you? And for him, what it was surprising, and it caught my ear too, was that he was simply affirmed by what he saw and how Jordan would talk and interact and how he went about his business, meaning that he was already thinking of some of these principles where you do have to constantly put in your work every day for, you know, the type of legacy that you're looking for, and how you can't do it alone. Where Michael Jordan had a nice beginning of his career, but until he got Scottie Pippen and surrounded himself with other role players, then he was finally able to achieve what he wanted to, and that was eventually six championships with the Bulls. And one part too that Mahomes said yesterday is he's not going to lie here and say that he would be as good without his supporting cast. And just to realize that, especially in this day and age when everyone is chasing the maximum amount of money you could possibly have, I mean, this is a guy who probably could have stood to make a percentage of the salary cap, or $50 or $60 million, but he insisted, okay, I have trust in the team, and let's make sure the team is good so that my legacy can really be one of the best legacies in the history of the National Football League.
We're speaking to Pete Sweeney, who covers the Kansas City Chiefs for SB Nation.
Well, Pete, hearing all that about, you know, the Michael Jordan, how he wanted to go about things, what is Patrick Mahomes, as I call him, Mahomes, is his leadership style? Because you talk about Michael Jordan, I don't think their leadership styles are the same. He kind of ruled with an iron fist.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a couple Mahomes stories where he had a veteran like Sammy Watkins last year that maybe wasn't running hard enough to win races with his fellow wide receivers. And Mahomes was barking at him and made sure that he ran. And Sammy said later on that he was happy that Mahomes did that he's demanding more. Same thing with Mecole Hardman. Mecole Hardman came in last year as a rookie, and toward the beginning of workouts, there were plays where, you know, typically for an NFL quarterback, 10 to 15 seconds runs by and the play's pretty much over. The quarterback will have made his decision. So Mecole Hardman, within his internal clock, would say, okay, 10 or 15 seconds left, I can stop running. But Patrick Mahomes, the play is never over. I mean, the play could go on for another 15 to 20 to 30 seconds, depending on how much time he's buying himself out of structure. So that was something that Pat felt he had to tell Mahomes, or Pat felt he had to tell Mecole, I should say, to, in these situations where we're practicing, you never stop running. And that's something we've heard from Travis Kelce, and it has turned into somewhat of a joke where these guys never know when the play is over, so they continue to try to find a way to get open. And then I think there was an interesting comparison, and my deputy editor pointed it out to me, and I went back and looked at some of this. When the Baltimore Ravens were trailing in the playoffs, Lamar Jackson kind of got a little bit dejected. His body language wasn't good. He was at the end of the bench. They sort of knew that their run was going to be over when they were losing to the Tennessee Titans. Whereas Patrick Mahomes, I mean, you saw him down in the playoffs three times. And, you know, you watch the NFL films, and the NFL is fortunate to have such a good NFL film crew. He's barking up and down the sidelines, you know, make them remember us. Let's do something special. Down 24 points against the Texans. Down 10 points against the Titans. And then the San Francisco 49ers late in the game. You know, he basically was on his feet yelling at his guys to say, okay, if we can accomplish this, they're going to remember this forever. And he was right. And I think the Chiefs really respect him. And a lot of these Chiefs are aware that they're playing with one of the best players in the history of the National Football League, and just how rare that is.
Well, that's why he got a historical contract. I guess I want to know a little bit more details. I don't know if this was stated, but he has some opts out in the contract where he can kind of redo it at some point in time in his contract?
So there's no opt out on the player side. There's opt in guarantee mechanisms for the Chiefs, meaning for the first time in history in a contract, the Chiefs basically have to guarantee Mahomes' deal for the full next year at the beginning of the league year on the third of the league year. So that what that prevents is, you know, a situation where they were to cut Mahomes and all of a sudden guys are settled with their quarterback. They have to do well in advance of free agency, let them know if they want Mahomes. Mahomes is 24 years old and the best quarterback in the league. They're going to accept this every year. Where it gets interesting is the cap hit for 2027. So leading up to 2027, next year the cap hit is still only $5.3 million. It then jumps up to $24.31 million and then in the 40s for a couple of years. 2027, the cap hit is $60 million. So a lot of people are thinking, okay, what they're going to end up doing is going through the first 7 years of this deal. And then when 2027, there may be some kind of restructure extension at that point when there are still 5 years left in the deal. In that spirit of keeping the Chiefs competitive, it's going to be hard, and it's really hard to think about because you think about how much can change in 7 years, the different names that are going to be on the Kansas City Chiefs. But, you know, you get a $60 million. Even if the cap has expanded by that point, you may need to want to restructure that money so that you can afford other supporting players. Again, that's a problem that they're going to have to deal with 7 years from now. So there's a lot of time to think about how they're going to handle that situation.
Is there a reason? I know you talked about he wanted to keep surrounding himself with really good players here. In his first 3 years, he doesn't make as much as Ryan Tannehill for the Titans, naturally. So I'm looking at that. Is that the reason why he took less in the front end of his contract than asking for more there?
Yeah, I think that's why it spread out. And he took less of a signing bonus as well. I think it was only $10 million, where a lot of other guys would have had a ridiculous signing bonus. So the Chiefs right now, in a very immediate future, the next 2 to 3 years, they're a little bit up against the cap. And what's hidden in this as well is on the defensive side of the football, they are right now automatically pivoting to, well, what are we going to do with Chris Jones? And Chris Jones is a guy who is franchise tagged at the moment, and he is looking for a long-term contract extension. The Chiefs have maintained that they want to sign Chris Jones to a long-term deal, but the problem that they've been running into is that Chris Jones wants Aaron Donald, the Forrest Buckner-type money, and the Chiefs don't value him as that much. So that may be something that won't get decided, but what they do need right now is cap space to do anything when it comes to Chris Jones. And so, yes, I think that was part of it in saying, all right, let's try to make the cap hit a little bit smaller in these first few years. And now you buy time until 2023. It's 2023 that it jumps up to about $40 million. So that really gives the Chiefs 3 years to figure this out. And the thing that sticks with me yesterday is General Manager Brett Veach said, yeah, we understand that this is a big number, but what the advantage is that it's manageable, and now we know exactly what it is. So for the longest time, it was hard to really team build around Patrick Mahomes because he just didn't know what that number was going to be. Now they do. And so now it could spell trouble, I think, for the rest of the National Football League, because the Chiefs now have a really good grip of their numbers. They were in what would be called and joked about in Kansas City cap hell just a few years ago, and now they're finally silenced their way through.
Pete, great work, and stay safe, and we'll speak to you down the line.
Yes. Well, thank you guys for having me on this morning, and have a good day.
Appreciate it.
All right, that's Pete Sweeney from SB Nation, radio personality in Kansas City. Anything more, Blaine, that you learned, you know, that you feel like you know now about the Mahomes deal?
No, not at all. Actually, I was more on the personal side, that he has leadership skills, and he's a humble guy who doesn't have a huge ego. That's what I learned.
Yeah, you know, the old line, I trade my past for his future. Well, yeah, that's what a lot of people would say about him. Anyway, that's it for us. Our future is, we'll speak to you again tomorrow. Midday 180 is next. Be safe. Have a great day.
Happy Wednesday.
Wu-Tang, y'all.